I told them everything just as it was. Ivan wondered inwardly again. If I thought of anything then, he began again, it was solely of some wickedness on your part. Dmitri might kill him, but that he would steal. I did not believe that then, but I was prepared for any wickedness from you. You told me yourself you could sham a fit. What did you say that for? It was just through my simplicity, and I never have shammed a fit and purpose in my life. And I only said so then to boast to you. It was just foolishness. I liked you so much then and was open-hearted with you. My brother directly accuses you of the murder and theft. What else is left for him to do? Said Smerdyakov with a bitter grin. And who will believe him with all the proofs against him? Grigory Vasilievich saw the door open. What can he say after that? But never mind him, he's trembling to save himself. He slowly ceased speaking and suddenly, as though on reflection, added, And look here again, he wants to throw it on me and make out that it is the work of my hands. I've heard that already. But as to my being clever at shamming a fit, should I have told you beforehand that I could sham one if I really had such a design against your father? If I'd been planning such a murder, could I have been such a fool as to give such evidence against myself beforehand? And to his son, too? Upon my word, is that likely? As if that could be. Such a thing has never happened. No one hears this talk of ours now, except Providence itself. And if you were to tell of it to the prosecutor and Nikolai Parfenovich, you might defend me completely by doing so, for who would be likely to be such a criminal if he's open-hearted beforehand? Anyone can see that. Well, and Ivan got up to cut short the conversation, struck by Smerdyakov's last argument. I don't suspect you at all, and I think it's absurd indeed to suspect you. On the contrary, I'm grateful to you for setting my mind at rest. Now I'm going, but I'll come again. Meanwhile, goodbye. Get well. Is there anything you want? I'm very thankful for everything. Marfa Ignatyevna does not forget me, and provides me anything I want, according to her kindness. Good people visit me every day. Goodbye, but I shan't say anything of your being able to sham a fit, and I don't advise you to either. Something made Ivan say suddenly, I quite understand, and if you don't speak of that, I shall say nothing of that conversation of ours at the gate. Then it happened that Ivan went out, and only when he'd gone a dozen steps along the corridor, he suddenly felt that there was an insulting significance in Smerdyakov's last words. He was almost on the point of turning back, but it was only a passing impulse, and muttering, Nonsense! He went out of the hospital. His chief feeling was one of relief at the fact that it was not Smerdyakov, but Mitya, who had committed the murder, though he might have been expected to feel the opposite. He did not want to analyze the reason for this feeling, and even felt a positive repugnance at prying into his sensations. He felt as though he wanted to make haste to forget something. In the following days he became convinced of Mitya's guilt, as he got to know all the weight of evidence against him. There was evidence of people of no importance, Fenya and her mother, for instance. But the effect of it was almost overpowering. As to Perhotin, the people at the tavern and at Plotnikov's shop, as well as the witnesses at Mokroe, their evidence seemed conclusive. It was the details that were so damning. The secret of the knocks impressed the lawyers almost as much as Grigory's evidence as to the open door. Grigory's wife, Marfa, in answer to Ivan's questions, declared that Smerdyakov had been lying all night the other side of the partition wall. He was not 3 paces from our bed, and that although she was a sound sleeper, she waked several times and heard him moaning. He was moaning the whole time, moaning continually. Talking to Hertz and Stuber, and giving it as his opinion that Smerdyakov was not mad, but only rather weak, Ivan only evoked from the old man a subtle smile. "Do you know how he spends his time now?" he asked. Learning lists of French words by heart. He has an exercise book under his pillow with the French words written out in Russian letters for him by someone. Ivan ended by dismissing all doubts. He could not think of Dmitri without repulsion. Only one thing was strange, however. Alyosha persisted that Dmitri was not the murderer, and that in all probability Smerdyakov was. Ivan always felt that Alyosha's opinion meant a great deal to him, and so he was astonished at it now. Another thing that was strange was that Alyosha did not make any attempt to talk about Mitya with Ivan, that he never began on the subject, and only answered his questions. This, too, struck Ivan particularly. But he was very much preoccupied at that time with something quite apart from that. On his return from Moscow, he abandoned himself hopelessly to his mad and consuming passion for Katerina Ivanovna. This is not the time to begin to speak of this new passion of Ivan's, which left its mark on all the rest of his life. This would furnish the subject for another novel, which I perhaps may never write. But I cannot omit to mention here that when Ivan, on leaving Katerina Ivanovna with Alyosha, as I've related already, told him, "I'm not keen on her," it was an absolute lie. He loved her madly, though at times he hated her so that he might have murdered her. Many causes helped to bring about this feeling. Shattered by what had happened with Mitya, she rushed on Ivan's return to meet him as her one salvation. She was hurt, insulted, and humiliated in her feelings. And here the man had come back to her, who had loved her so ardently before. Oh, she knew that very well. And whose heart and intellect she considered so superior to her own. But the sternly virtuous girl did not abandon herself altogether to the man she loved, in spite of the Karamazov violence of his passions and the great fascination he had for her. She was continually tormented at the same time by remorse for having deserted Mitya, and in moments of discord and violent anger, and they were numerous, she told Ivan so plainly. This is what he had called to Alyosha, lies upon lies. There was, of course, much that was false in it, and that angered Ivan more than anything. But of all this, later. He did, in fact, for a time, almost forget Smerdyakov's existence, and yet a fortnight after his first visit to him, he began to be haunted by the same strange thoughts as before. It's enough to say that he was continually asking himself, why was it that on that last night in Fyodor Pavlovich's house, he had crept out onto the stairs like a thief, and listened to hear what his father was doing below? Why had he recalled that afterwards with repulsion? Why, next morning, had he been suddenly so depressed on the journey? Why, as he reached Moscow, had he said to himself, I am a scoundrel? And now he almost fancied that these tormenting thoughts would make him even forgive Katerina Ivanovna, so completely did they take possession of him again. It was just after fancying this that he met Alyosha in the street. He stopped him at once and put a question to him. Do you remember when Dmitri burst in after dinner and beat father, and afterwards I told you in the yard that I reserved the right to desire? Tell me, did you think then that I desired father's death or not? I did think so, answered Alyosha softly. It was so, too. It was not a matter of guessing. But didn't you fancy then that what I wished was just that one reptile should devour another? That is, just that Dmitri should kill father, and as soon as possible, and that I myself was even prepared to help to bring that about? Alyosha turned rather pale and looked silently into his brother's face. Speak, cried Ivan. I want above everything to know what you thought then. I want the truth. The truth. He drew a deep breath, looking angrily at Alyosha, before his answer came. Forgive me, I did think that too, at the time, whispered Alyosha, and he did not add one softening phrase. Thanks, snapped Ivan, and leaving Alyosha, he went quickly on his way. From that time, Alyosha noticed that Ivan began obviously to avoid him and seemed to have taken a dislike to him, so much so that Alyosha gave up going to see him. Immediately after that meeting with him, Ivan had not gone home but went straight to Smerdyakov again. Chapter 7 The Second Visit to Smerdyakov. By that time, Smerdyakov had been discharged from the hospital. Ivan knew his new lodging, the dilapidated little wooden house, divided in two by a passage, on one side of which lived Maria Kondratyevna and her mother, and on the other Smerdyakov. No one knew on what terms he lived with them, whether as a friend or as a lodger. It was supposed afterwards that he'd come to stay with them as Maria Kondratyevna's betrothed, and was living there for a time without paying for board or lodging. Both mother and daughter had the greatest respect for him, and looked upon him as greatly superior to themselves. Ivan knocked, and on the door being opened, went into the passage. By Maria Kondratyevna's directions, he went straight to the better room on the left, occupied by Smerdyakov. There was a tiled stove in the room, and it was extremely hot. The walls were gay with blue paper, which was a good deal used, however, and in the cracks under it cockroaches swarmed in amazing numbers, so that there was a continual rustling from them. The furniture was very scanty, two benches against each wall, and two chairs by the table. The table of plain wood was covered with a cloth with pink patterns on it. There was a pot of geranium on each of the two little windows. In the corner there was a case of icons. On the table stood a little copper samovar with many dents in it, and a tray with two cups. But Smerdyakov had finished tea, and the samovar was out. He was sitting at the table on a bench. He was looking at an exercise book and slowly writing with a pen. There was a bottle of ink by him, and a flat iron candlestick, but with a composite candle. Ivan saw at once from Smerdyakov's face that he had completely recovered from his illness. His face was fresher, fuller, his hair stood up jauntily in front, and was plastered down at the sides. He was sitting in a parti-coloured, wadded dressing gown, rather dirty and frayed, however. He had spectacles on his nose, which Ivan had never seen him wearing before. This trifling circumstance suddenly redoubled Ivan's anger. A creature like that and wearing spectacles! Smerdyakov slowly raised his head and looked intently at his visitor through his spectacles. Then he slowly took them off and rose from the bench, but by no means respectfully, almost lazily, doing the least possible required by common civility. All this struck Ivan instantly. He took it all in and noted it at once. Most of all, the look in Smerdyakov's eyes. Positively malicious, churlish, and haughty. "What do you want to intrude for?" it seemed to say. "We settled everything then. Why have you come again?" Ivan could scarcely control himself. "It's hot here," he said, still standing, and unbuttoned his overcoat. "Take off your coat," Smerdyakov conceded. Ivan took off his coat and threw it on a bench with trembling hands. He took a chair, moved it quickly to the table and sat down. Smerdyakov managed to sit down on his bench before him. "To begin with, are we alone?" Ivan asked sternly and impulsively. "Can they overhear us in there?" "No one can hear anything. You've seen for yourself there's a passage. Listen, my good fellow, what was that you babbled as I was leaving the hospital? That if I said nothing about your faculty of shamming fits, you wouldn't tell the investigating lawyer all our conversation at the gate. What do you mean by all? What could you mean by it? Were you threatening me? Have I entered into some sort of compact with you? Do you suppose I'm afraid of you?" Ivan said this in a perfect fury, giving him to understand with obvious intention that he scorned any subterfuge or indirectness, and meant to show his cards. Smerdyakov's eyes gleamed resentfully, his left eye winked, and he at once gave his answer with his habitual composure and deliberation. "You want to have everything about board? Very well, you shall have it," he seemed to say. "This is what I meant then, and this is why I said that you, knowing beforehand of this murder of your own parent, left him to his fate, and that people mightn't after that conclude any evil about your feelings, and perhaps of something else too. That's what I promised not to tell the authorities." Though Smerdyakov spoke without haste and obviously controlling himself, yet there was something in his voice, determined and emphatic, resentful and insolently defiant. He stared impudently at Ivan. A mist passed before Ivan's eyes for the first moment. "How? What? Are you out of your mind? I'm perfectly in possession of all my faculties. Do you suppose I knew of the murder?" Ivan cried at last, and he brought his fist violently on the table. "What do you mean by something else, too? Speak, scoundrel!" Smerdyakov was silent and still scanned Ivan with the same insolent stare. "Speak, you stinking rogue! What is that something else, too?" "The something else I meant was that you probably, too, are very desirous of your parents' death." Ivan jumped up and struck him with all his might on the shoulder, so that he fell back against the wall. In an instant his face was bathed in tears, saying, "It's a shame, sir, to strike a sick man." He dried his eyes with a very dirty blue check handkerchief and sank into quiet weeping. A minute passed.
"That's enough. Leave off," Ivan said peremptorily, sitting down again. "Don't put me out of all patience."
Smerdyakov took the rag from his eyes. Every line of his puckered face reflected the insult he'd just received.
"So you thought then, you scoundrel, that together with Dmitri I meant to kill my father?" "I didn't know what thoughts were in your mind then," said Smerdyakov resentfully, "and so I stopped you then at the gate to sound you on that very point."
"To sound what? What?"
"Why, that very circumstance, whether you wanted your father to be murdered or not."
What infuriated Ivan more than anything was the aggressive, insolent tone to which Smerdyakov persistently adhered.
"It was you murdered him,"
he cried suddenly. Smerdyakov smiled contemptuously.
"You know of yourself for a fact that it wasn't I murdered him, and I should have thought that there was no need for a sensible man to speak of it again.
But why had you such a suspicion about me at the time?
As you know already, it was simply from fear, for I was in such a position, shaking with fear, that I suspected everyone. I resolved to sound you, too, for I thought if you wanted the same as your brother, then the business was as good as settled, and I should be crushed like a fly, too."
"Look here, you didn't say that a fortnight ago."
"I meant the same when I talked to you in the hospital, only I thought you'd understand without wasting words, and that being such a sensible man, you wouldn't care to talk of it openly."
"What next? Come, answer, answer, I insist. What was it? What could I have done to put such a degrading suspicion into your mean soul?"
"As for the murder, you couldn't have done that and didn't want to. But as for wanting someone else to do it, that was just what you did want."
"And how coolly he speaks.
But why should I have wanted it? What grounds had I for wanting it?"
"What grounds had you? What about the inheritance?" said Smerdyakov sarcastically, and, as it were, vindictively.
"Why, after your parents' death, there was at least 40,000 to come to each of you, and very likely more. But if Fyodor Pavlovich got married then to that lady Agrafena Alexandrovna, she would have had all his capital made over to her directly after the wedding, for she's plenty of sense, so that your parent would not have left you 2 rubles between the three of you. And were they far from a wedding, either? Not a hair's breadth. That lady had only to lift her little finger and he'd have run after her to church with his tongue out."
Ivan restrained himself with painful effort.
"Very good," he commented at last. "You see, I haven't jumped up. I haven't knocked you down. I haven't killed you. Speak on. So according to you, I had fixed on Dmitri to do it. I was reckoning on him. How could you help reckoning on him? If he killed him, then he would lose all the rights of a nobleman, his rank and property, and would go off to exile. So his share of the inheritance would come to you and your brother, Alexei Fyodorovich, in equal parts. So you'd each have not 40, but 60,000 each. There's not a doubt you did reckon on Dmitri Fyodorovich."
"What I put up with from you? Listen, scoundrel. If I'd reckoned on anyone, then it would have been on you, not on Dmitri, and I swear I did expect some wickedness from you at the time. I remember my impression.
I thought, too, for a minute, at the time, that you were reckoning on me as well," said Smerdyakov with a sarcastic grin, "so that it was just by that, more than anything, you showed me what was in your mind. For if you had a foreboding about me and yet went away, you as good as said to me, 'You can murder my parent, I won't hinder you.'"
"You scoundrel! So that's how you understood it?"
"It was all that going to Chermashenye. Why? You were meaning to go to Moscow and refused all your father's entreaties to go to Chermashenye, and simply at a foolish word from me, you consented at once. What reason had you to consent to Chermashenye? Since you went to Chermashenye with no reason, simply at my word, it shows that you must have expected something from me."
"No, I swear I didn't!" shouted Ivan, grinding his teeth.
"You didn't? Then you ought, as your father's son, to have had me taken to the lock-up and thrashed at once for my words then, or at least to have given me a punch in the face on the spot. But you were not a bit angry, if you please, and at once, in a friendly way, acted on my foolish word and went away, which was hardly absurd, for you ought to have stayed to save your parents' life. How could I help drawing my conclusions?"
Ivan sat scowling, both his fists convulsively pressed on his knees.
"Yes, I'm sorry I didn't punch you in the face," he said with a bitter smile. "I couldn't have taken you to the lock-up just then. Who would have believed me? And what charge could I bring against you?
But the punch in the face. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't think of it. Though blows are forbidden, I should have pounded your ugly face to a jelly.
Smerdyakov looked at him almost with relish. In the ordinary occasions of life, he said in the same complacent and sententious tone in which he taunted Grigory and argued with him about religion at Fyodor Pavlovich's table. In the ordinary occasions of life, blows on the face are forbidden nowadays by law, and people have given them up. But in exceptional occasions of life, people still fly to blows, not only among us, but all over the world, be it even the fullest Republic of France, just as in the time of Adam and Eve. And they never will leave off, but you, even in an exceptional case, did not dare.
What are you learning French words for?
Ivan nodded toward the exercise book lying on the table. Why shouldn't I learn them so as to improve my education, supposing that I may myself chance to go some day to those happy parts of Europe? Listen, monster, Ivan's eyes flashed, and he trembled all over. I'm not afraid of your accusations. You can say what you like about me. And if I don't beat you to death, it's simply because I suspect you of that crime, and I'll drag you to justice. I'll unmask you. To my thinking, you better keep quiet, for what can you accuse me of, considering my absolute innocence? And who would believe you? Only, if you begin, I shall tell everything too, for I must defend myself.
Do you think I'm afraid of you now?
If the court doesn't believe all I've said to you just now, the public will, and you will be ashamed.
That's as much as to say, it's always worthwhile speaking to a sensible man, eh?
Snarled Ivan. You hit the mark indeed, and you better be sensible.
Ivan got up, shaking all over with indignation, put on his coat, and without replying further to Smerdyakov, without even looking at him, walked quickly out of the cottage. The cool evening air refreshed him. There was a bright moon in the sky. A nightmare of ideas and sensations filled his soul. Shall I go at once and give information against Smerdyakov? But what information can I give? He's not guilty anyway. On the contrary, he'll accuse me. And in fact, why did I set off for Chermashnya then? What for? What for? Ivan asked himself. Yes, of course, I was expecting something, and he is right. And he remembered for the 100th time how on that last night in his father's house he'd listened on the stairs, but he remembered it now with such anguish that he stood still on the spot as though he'd been stabbed. Yes, I expected it then, that's true. I wanted the murder. I did want the murder. Did I want the murder? Did I want it? I must kill Smerdyakov. If I don't dare kill Smerdyakov now, life is not worth living. Ivan did not go home, but went straight to Katerina Ivanovna's and alarmed her by his appearance. He was like a madman. He repeated all his conversation with Smerdyakov, every syllable of it. He couldn't be calmed, however much he tried to soothe him. He kept walking about the room, speaking strangely, disconnectedly. At last he sat down, put his elbows on the table, leaned his head on his hands, and pronounced this strange sentence. If it's not Dmitri, but Smerdyakov, who's the murderer, I share his guilt, for I put him up to it. Whether I did, I don't know yet. But if he is the murderer, not Dmitri, then, of course, I'm the murderer too. When Katerina Ivanovna heard that, she got up from her seat without a word, went to her writing table, opened a box standing on it, took out a sheet of paper, and laid it before Ivan. This was the document of which Ivan spoke to Alyosha later on as a conclusive proof that Dmitri had killed his father. This was the letter written by Mitya to Katerina Ivanovna when he was drunk. On the very evening he met Alyosha at the crossroads on the way to the monastery, after the scene at Katerina Ivanovna's when Grushenka had insulted her. Then, parting from Alyosha, Mitya had rushed to Grushenka. I don't know whether he saw her, but in the evening he was at the Metropolis, where he got thoroughly drunk. Then he asked for pen and paper and wrote a document of weighty consequence to himself. It was a wordy, disconnected, frantic letter, a drunken letter, in fact. It was like the talk of a drunken man who, on his return home, begins with extraordinary heat, telling his wife or one of his household how he has just been insulted, what a rascal had just insulted him, what a fine fellow he is, on the other hand, and how he will pay that scoundrel out. And all that at great length, with great excitement and incoherence, with drunken tears and blows on the table. The letter was written on a dirty piece of ordinary paper of the cheapest kind. It had been provided by the tavern, and there were figures scrawled on the back of it. There was evidently not space enough for his drunken verbosity, and Mitya not only filled the margins, but had written the last line right across the rest. The letter ran as follows. "Fatal catcher. Tomorrow I'll get the money and repay you 3,000, and farewell, woman of great wrath, but farewell too, my love. Let us make an end. Tomorrow I shall try and get it from everyone. If I can't borrow it, I give him my word of honour I shall go to my father and break his skull and take the money from under the pillow, if only Ivan has gone. If I had to go to Siberia for it, I'll give you back your 3,000. And farewell, I bow down to the ground before you, for I've been a scoundrel to you. Forgive me. No, better not forgive me, you'll be happier, and so shall I. Better Siberia than your love, for I love another woman, and you got to know her too well today. So how can you forgive? I will murder the man who's robbed me. I'll leave you all and go to the east so as to see no one again. Not her, either, for you're not my only tormentress, she is too. Farewell. P.S. I write my curse, but I adore you. I hear it in my heart. One string is left, and it vibrates. Better tear my heart in two, I shall kill myself, but first of all, that cur, I shall tear 3,000 from him and fling it to you. Though I've been a scoundrel to you, I'm not a thief. You can expect 3,000. The cur keeps it under his mattress, in pink ribbon. I'm not a thief, but I'll murder my thief. Katya, don't look disdainful. Dmitri is not a thief, but a murderer. He has murdered his father and ruined himself to hold his ground rather than endure your pride. And he doesn't love you. P.P.S. I kiss your feet. Farewell. P.P.P.S. Katya, pray to God that someone will give me the money. Then I shall not be steeped in gore, and if no one does, I shall. Kill me. Your slave and enemy, D. Karamazov.
When Ivan read this document, he was convinced. So then it was his brother, not Smerdyakov. And if not Smerdyakov, then not he, Ivan. This letter had once assumed in his eyes the aspect of a logical proof. There could be no longer the slightest doubt of Mitya's guilt. The suspicion never occurred to Ivan, by the way, that Mitya might have committed the murder in conjunction with Smerdyakov, and indeed such a theory did not fit in with the facts. Ivan was completely reassured. The next morning he only thought of Smerdyakov and his jibes with contempt. A few days later he positively wondered how he could have been so horribly distressed at his suspicions. He resolved to dismiss him with contempt and forget him. So passed a month. He made no further inquiry about Smerdyakov, but twice he happened to hear that he was very ill and out of his mind. "He'll end in madness," the young Dr. Varvinsky observed about him, and even remembered this. During the last week of that month Ivan himself began to feel very ill. He went to consult the Moscow doctor who had been sent for by Katerina Ivanovna just before the trial. And just at that time his relations with Katerina Ivanovna became acutely strained. They were like two enemies in love with one another. Katerina Ivanovna's returns to Mitya, that is, her brief but violent revulsions of feeling in his favour, drove Ivan to perfect frenzy. Strange to say, until that last scene described above, when Alyosha came from Mitya to Katerina Ivanovna, Ivan had never once, during that month, heard her express a doubt of Mitya's guilt, in spite of those returns that were so hateful to him. It is remarkable, too, that while he felt that he hated Mitya more and more every day, he realized that it was not on account of Katya's returns that he hated him, but just because he was the murderer of his father. He was conscious of this and fully recognized it to himself. Nevertheless, he went to see Mitya 10 days before the trial and proposed to him a plan of escape, a plan he had obviously thought over a long time. He was partly impelled to do this by a sore place still left in his heart from a phrase of Smerdyakov, that it was to his, Ivan's, advantage that his brother should be convicted, as that would increase his inheritance and Alyosha's from 40,000 to 60,000 rubles. He determined to sacrifice 30,000 on arranging Mitya's escape. On his return from seeing him, he was very mournful and dispirited. He suddenly began to feel that he was anxious for Mitya's escape, not only to heal that sore place by sacrificing 30,000, but for another reason.
Is it because I am as much a murderer at heart? He asked himself. Something very deep down seemed burning and rankling in his soul. His pride, above all, suffered cruelly all that month. But of that later. When, after his conversation with Alyosha, Ivan suddenly decided with his hand on the bell of his lodging to go to Smerdyakov, he obeyed a sudden and peculiar impulse of indignation. He suddenly remembered how Katerina Ivanovna had only just cried out to him in Alyosha's presence. It was you, persuaded me of his, that is, Mitya's, guilt. Ivan was thunderstruck when he recalled it. He had never once tried to persuade her that Mitya was the murderer. On the contrary, he had suspected himself in her presence that time when he came back from Smerdyakov. It was she who had produced that document and proved his brother's guilt. And now she suddenly exclaimed, I've been at Smerdyakov's myself. When had she been there? Ivan had known nothing of it. So she was not at all so sure of Mitya's guilt. And what could Smerdyakov have told her? What had he said to her? His heart burned with violent anger. He could not understand how he could, half an hour before, have let those words pass and not have cried out at the moment. He let go of the bell and rushed off to Smerdyakov. I shall kill him, perhaps this time, he thought on the way. Chapter 8. The third and last interview with Smerdyakov. When he was halfway there, the keen, dry wind that had been blowing early that morning rose again, and a fine, dry snow began falling thickly. It did not lie on the ground, but was whirled about by the wind, and soon there was a regular snowstorm. There were scarcely any lampposts in the part of the town where Smerdyakov lived. Ivan strode alone in the darkness, unconscious of the storm, instinctively picking out his way. His head ached, and there was a painful throbbing in his temples. He felt that his hands were twitching convulsively. Not far from Maria Kondratyevna's cottage, Ivan suddenly came upon a solitary, drunken little peasant. He was wearing a coarse and patched coat and was walking in zigzags, grumbling and swearing to himself. Then suddenly he would begin singing in a husky, drunken voice, Ugh, Vanka's gone to Petersburg. I won't wait till he comes back. But he broke off every time at the second line and began swearing again. Then he would begin the same song again. Ivan felt an intense hatred for him before he'd thought about him at all. Suddenly he realized his presence and felt an irresistible impulse to knock him down. At that moment they met, and the peasant, with a violent lurch, fell full tilt against Ivan, who pushed him back furiously. The peasant went flying backwards and fell like a log on the frozen ground. He uttered one plaintive, Oh! And then was silent. Ivan stepped up to him. He was lying on his back without movement or consciousness. You will be frozen, thought Ivan, and he went on his way to Smerdyakov's. In the passage, Maria Kondratyevna, who ran out to open the door with a candle in her hand, whispered that Smerdyakov was very ill. It's not that he's laid up, but he seems not himself. And he even told us to take the tea away, he wouldn't have any. Why, does he make a row? Asked Ivan coarsely. Oh, dear, no, quite the contrary, he's very quiet. Only please don't talk to him too long, Maria Kondratyevna begged him. Ivan opened the door and stepped into the room. It was overheated as before, but there were changes in the room. One of the benches at the side had been removed, and in its place had been put a large old mahogany leather sofa, on which a bed had been made up, with fairly clean white pillows. Smerdyakov was sitting on the sofa, wearing the same dressing gown. The table had been brought out in front of the sofa, so that there was hardly room to move. On the table lay a thick book in yellow cover, but Smerdyakov was not reading it. He seemed to be sitting alone, doing nothing. He met Ivan with a slow, silent gaze, and was apparently not at all surprised at his coming. There was a great change in his face. He was much thinner and sallower. His eyes were sunken, and there were blue marks under them. Why, you really are ill! Ivan stopped short. I won't keep you long. I won't even take off my coat. Where can one sit down? He went to the other end of the table, moved up a chair, and sat down on it. Why do you look at me without speaking? I've only come with one question, and I swear I won't go without an answer. Has the young lady, Katerina Ivanovna, been with you? Smerdyakov still remained silent, looking quietly at Ivan as before. Suddenly, with a motion of his hand, he turned his face away. What's the matter with you?
cried Ivan.
Nothing.
What do you mean by nothing?
Yes, she has. It's no matter to you. Let me alone.
No, I won't let you alone. Tell me, when was she here?
Why, I'd quite forgotten about her, said Smerdyakov with a scornful smile.
And turning his face to Ivan again, he stared at him with a look of frenzied hatred. The same look that he'd fixed on him at their last interview a month before.
You seem very ill yourself. Your face is sunken. You don't look like yourself, he said to Ivan.
Never mind my health. Tell me what I ask you.
But why are your eyes so yellow? The whites are quite yellow. Are you so worried?
He smiled contemptuously and suddenly laughed outright.
Listen, I've told you I won't go away without an answer.
Ivan cried, intensely irritated.
Why do you keep pestering me? Why do you torment me?
Said Smerdyakov with a look of suffering.
Damn it, I've nothing to do with you. Just answer my question now. Go away.
I've no answer to give you, said Smerdyakov, looking down again.
You may be sure I'll make you answer.
Why? Are you so uneasy?
Smerdyakov stared at him, not simply with contempt, but almost with a repulsion.
Is this because the trial begins tomorrow?
Nothing will happen to you. Can't you believe that at last? Go home, go to bed and sleep in peace. Don't be afraid of anything.
I don't understand you. What have I to be afraid of tomorrow?
Ivan articulated in astonishment, and suddenly a chill breath of fear did in fact pass over his soul. Smerdyakov measured him with his eyes.
You don't understand, he drawled reproachfully. It's a strange thing a sensible man should care to play such a farce.
Ivan looked at him speechless. The startling, incredibly supercilious tone of this man, who had once been his valet, was extraordinary in itself. He had not taken such a tone even at their last interview.
I tell you, you've nothing to be afraid of. I won't say anything about you. There's no proof against you. I say, how your hands are trembling. Why are your fingers moving like that? Go home. You did not murder him.
Ivan started. He remembered Alyosha.
I know it was not I, he faltered.
Do you?
Smerdyakov caught him up again. Ivan jumped up and seized him by the shoulder.
Tell me everything, you viper! Tell me everything!
Smerdyakov was not in the least scared. He only riveted his eyes on Ivan with intense hatred.
Well, it was you who murdered him, if that's it, he whispered furiously.
Ivan sank back on his chair as though pondering something. He laughed malignantly.
You mean my going away? What you talked about last time?
You stood before me last time and understood it all, and you understand it now.
All I understand is that you're mad.
Aren't you tired of it? Here we are, face to face. What's the use of going on, keeping up a farce to each other? Are you still trying to throw it all on me, to my face? You murdered him. You are the real murderer. I was only your instrument, your faithful servant, and it was following your words I did it.
Did it? Why? Did you murder him?
Ivan turned cold. Something seemed to give way in his brain, and he shuddered all over with a cold shiver. Then Smerdyakov himself looked at him wonderingly. Probably the genuineness of Ivan's horror struck him.
You don't mean to say you really did not know?
He faltered mistrustfully, looking with a forced smile into his eyes. Ivan still gazed at him and seemed unable to speak.
Ach, Vanka's gone to Petersburg. I won't wait till he comes back.
Suddenly echoed in his head.
Do you know, I'm afraid that you are a dream, a phantom sitting before me.
He muttered.
It's no phantom here, but only us two, and one other. No doubt he is here, that third between us.
Who is he? Who is here? What third person?
Ivan cried in alarm, looking about him, his eyes hastily searching in every corner.
That third is God himself, Providence. He's the third beside us now. Only don't look for him, you won't find him.
It's a lie that you killed him,
Ivan cried madly.
You're mad or teasing me again?
Smerdyakov, as before, watched him curiously, with no sign of fear.
He could still scarcely get over his incredulity. He still fancied that Ivan knew everything and was trying to throw it all on him to his face. "Wait a minute," he said at last in a weak voice, and suddenly bringing up his left leg from under the table, he began turning up his trouser leg. He was wearing long white stockings and slippers. Slowly he took off his garter and fumbled to the bottom of his stocking. Ivan gazed at him and suddenly shuddered in a paroxysm of terror. "He's mad!" he cried, and rapidly jumping up he drew back, so that he knocked his back against the wall and stood up against it stiff and straight. He looked with insane terror at Smerdyakov, who, entirely unaffected by his terror, continued fumbling in his stocking, as though he were making an effort to get hold of something with his fingers and pull it out. At last he got hold of it and began pulling it out. Ivan saw that it was a piece of paper, or perhaps a roll of papers. Smerdyakov pulled it out and laid it on the table. "Here," he said quietly.
"What is it?"
responded Ivan, trembling. "Kindly look at it." Smerdyakov answered, still in the same low tone. Ivan stepped up to the table, took up the roll of paper, and began unfolding it. But suddenly he drew back his fingers as though from contact with a loathsome reptile.
"Your hands keep twitching," observed Smerdyakov,
and he deliberately unfolded the bundle himself. Under the wrapper were three packets of 100-ruble notes.
"They're all here, all the 3,000 rubles. You need not count them. Take them,"
Smerdyakov suggested to Ivan, nodding at the notes. Ivan sank back in his chair. He was as white as a handkerchief.
"You frighten me with your stocking,"
he said, with a strange grin.
"Can you really not have known till now?"
Smerdyakov asked once more.
"No, I did not know. I kept thinking of Dmitri. Brother, brother, ugh!"
He suddenly clutched his head in both hands.
"Listen, did you kill him alone? With my brother's help or without?"
"It was only with you, with your help. I killed him, and Dmitri Fyodorovich is quite innocent."
"All right, all right. Talk about me later. Why do I keep on trembling? I can't speak properly."
"You were bold enough then. You said everything was lawful. And how frightened you are now."
Smerdyakov muttered in surprise.
"Well, do you have some lemonade? I'll ask for some at once. It's very refreshing. Only I must hide this first."
And again he motioned at the notes. He was just going to get up and call at the door to Maria Kondratyevna to make some lemonade and bring it them, but, looking for something to cover up the notes that she might not see them, he first took out his handkerchief, and, as it turned out to be very dirty, took up the big yellow book that Ivan had noticed at first lying on the table, and put it over the notes. The book was "The Sayings of the Holy Father Isaac the Syrian." Ivan read it mechanically.
"I won't have any lemonade," he said. "Talk of me later. Sit down and tell me how you did. Tell me all about it." "You better take off your greatcoat or you'll be too hot."
Ivan, as though he'd only just thought of it, took off his coat and, without getting up from his chair, threw it on the bench.
"Speak. Please, speak."
He seemed calmer. He waited, feeling sure that Smerdyakov would tell him all about it.
"How it was done," sighed Smerdyakov.
"It was done in a most natural way, following your very words."
"Of my words later,"
Ivan broke in again, apparently with complete self-possession, firmly uttering his words and not shouting as before.
"Only tell me in detail how you did it, everything as it happened. Don't forget anything. The details, above everything, the details, I beg you."
"Are you gone away? Then I fell into the cellar."
"In a fit or in a sham one?"
"A sham one, naturally. I shammed it all. I went quietly down the steps to the very bottom and lay down quietly. And as I lay down, I gave a scream and struggled till they carried me out."
"Stay. And were you shamming all along, afterwards and in the hospital?"
"No, not at all. Next day in the morning, before they took me to the hospital, I had a real attack and a more violent one than I've had for years. For 2 days I was quite unconscious."
All right, go on."
"They laid me on the bed. I knew I'd be the other side of the partition, for whenever I was ill, Marfa Ignatyevna used to put me there near them. She's always been very kind to me from my birth up. At night I moaned, but quietly. I kept expecting Dmitri Fyodorovich to come."
"Expecting him to come to you?"
Not to me. I expected him to come into the house, for I'd no doubt that he'd come that night. For being without me and getting no news, he'd be sure to come and climb over the fence as he used to and do something.
And if he hadn't come?
Then nothing would have happened. I should never have brought myself to it without him.
All right, all right. Speak more intelligibly. Don't hurry. Above all, don't leave anything out. I expected him to kill Fyodor Pavlovich. I thought that was certain, for I'd prepared him for it during the last few days. He knew about the knocks. That was the chief thing. With his suspiciousness and the fury which had been growing in him all those days, he was bound to get into the house by means of those taps. That was inevitable, so I was expecting him.
Stay, Ivan interrupted.
If he had killed him, he would have taken the money and carried it away. You must have considered that. What would you have got by it afterwards? I don't see.
But he would never have found the money. That was only what I told him, that the money was under the mattress. But that wasn't true. It had been lying in a box. And afterwards I suggested to Fyodor Pavlovich, as I was the only person he trusted, to hide the envelope with the notes in the corner behind the icons. For no one would have guessed that place, especially if they came in a hurry. So that's where the envelope lay, in the corner behind the icons. It would have been absurd to keep it under the mattress. The box, anyway, could be locked. But all believe it was under the mattress. A stupid thing to believe. So Dmitri Fyodorovich had committed the murder, finding nothing. He would either have run away in a hurry, afraid of every sound, as always happens with murderers, or he would have been arrested, so I could always have clambered up to the icons and have taken away the money next morning or even that night. And it would all have been put down to Dmitri Fyodorovich. I could reckon upon that.
But what if he did not kill him, but only knocked him down?
If he did not kill him, of course, I would not have ventured to take the money, and nothing would have happened. But I calculated that he would beat him senseless, and I should have time to take it then, and then I'd make out to Fyodor Pavlovich that it was no one but Dmitri Fyodorovich who had taken the money after beating him.
Stop, I'm getting mixed.
Then it was Dmitri, after all, who killed him. You only took the money.
No, he didn't kill him.
Well, I might as well have told you now that he was the murderer. But I don't want to lie to you now because if you really haven't understood till now, as I see for myself, and are not pretending, so as to throw your guilt on me to my very face, you're still responsible for it all, since you knew of the murder and charged me to do it, and went away, knowing all about it. And so I want to prove to your face this evening that you're the only real murderer in the whole affair, and I'm not the real murderer, though I did kill him. You're the rightful murderer.
Why? Why am I a murderer? Oh, God!
Ivan cried, unable to restrain himself at last, and forgetting that he had put off discussing himself till the end of the conversation.
You still mean that Chermashnev... Stay, tell me, why did you want my consent if you really took Chermashnev for consent? How will you explain that now?
Assured of your consent, I should have known that you wouldn't have made an outcry over those 3,000 being lost, even if I'd been suspected, instead of Dmitri Fyodorovich, or as his accomplice. On the contrary, you would have protected me from others. And when you got your inheritance, you would have rewarded me, when you were able, all the rest of your life. For you'd have received your inheritance through me, seeing that if he had married Agrafena Alexandrovna, you wouldn't have had a farthing.
Ah, then you intended to worry me all my life afterwards,
snarled Ivan. And what if I hadn't gone away then, but had informed against you?
What could you have informed? That I persuaded you to go to Chermashnev? That's all nonsense. Besides, after our conversation, you would either have gone away or have stayed. If you'd stayed, nothing would have happened. I should have known that you didn't want it done, and should have attempted nothing. As you went away, it meant you assured me that you wouldn't dare to inform against me at the trial, and that you'd overlook my having the 3,000. And indeed, you couldn't have prosecuted me afterwards, because then I should have told it all in the court. That is, not that I'd stolen the money or killed him, I should have said that, but that you'd put me up to the theft at the murder, though I didn't consent to it. That's why I needed your consent, so that you couldn't have cornered me afterwards. For what proof could you have had? I could always have cornered you, revealing your eagerness for your father's death, and I tell you the public would have believed it all, and you would have been ashamed for the rest of your life.
Was I so eager, then? Was I?
Ivan snarled again.
To be sure you were, and by your consent you silently sanctioned my doing it.
Smerdyakov looked resolutely at Ivan. He was very weak and spoke slowly and wearily.
but some hidden inner force urged him on. He evidently had some design. Ivan felt that.
"Go on," he said. "Tell me what happened that night." "What more is there to tell? I lay there and I thought I heard the master shout. And before that, Grigory Vasilievich had suddenly got up and came out, and he suddenly gave a scream. And then all was silence and darkness. I lay there waiting, my heart beating. I couldn't bear it. I got up at last, went out. I saw the window open on the left into the garden, and I stepped to the left to listen whether he was sitting there alive. And I heard the master moving about, sighing, so I knew he was alive. Eh, I thought. I went to the window and shouted to the master, 'It's I!' And he shouted to me, 'He's been, he's been, he's run away.' He meant Dmitri Fyodorovitch had been. 'He's killed Grigory.' 'Where?' I whispered. 'There, in the corner.' He pointed. He was whispering too. 'Wait a bit,' I said. I went to the corner of the garden to look, and there I came upon Grigory Vasilievich lying by the wall, covered with blood, senseless. So it's true that Dmitri Fyodorovitch has been here, was the thought that came into my head, and I determined on the spot to make an end of it, as Grigory Vasilievich, even if he were alive, would see nothing of it, as he lay there senseless. The only risk was that Marfa Ignatievna might wake up. I felt that at the moment, but the longing to get it done came over me till I could scarcely breathe.
But if there were none but the ecclesiastical court, the church would not even know, sentence a criminal to prison or to death. Crime, and the way of regarding it, would inevitably change. Not all at once, of course, but fairly soon. Ivan replied calmly without flinching. Are you serious? Miusov glanced keenly at him. If everything became the church, the church would exclude all the criminal and disobedient, and would not cut off their heads. Ivan went on. I ask you what would become of the excluded? He would be cut off then not only from men as now, but from Christ. By his crime he would have transgressed not only against men, but against the Church of Christ. This is so, even now, of course, strictly speaking. But it is not clearly enunciated. And very, very often the criminal of today compromises with his conscience. I steal, he says, but I don't go against church. I'm not an enemy of Christ. That's what the criminal of today is continually saying to himself. But when the church takes the place of the state, it will be difficult for him, in opposition to the church all over the world, to say, 'All men are mistaken, all in error, all mankind are the false church, I, a thief and murderer, am the only true Christian church.' It will be very difficult to say this to himself. It requires a rare combination of unusual circumstances. Now, on the other side, take the church's own view of crime. Is it not bound to renounce the present almost pagan attitude, and to change from a mechanical cutting off of its tainted member for the preservation of society, as at present, into completely and honestly adopting the idea of the regeneration of the man, of his reformation and salvation?' 'What do you mean? I fail to understand again. Something shapeless and even incomprehensible. What is excommunication? What sort of exclusion? I suspect you are simply amusing yourself, Ivan Fyodorovitch.' 'Yes, but you know, in reality it is so now,' said the elder suddenly, and all turned to him at once. 'If it were not for the Church of Christ, there would be nothing to restrain the criminal from evil doing. No real chastisement for it afterwards. None, that is, but the mechanical punishment spoken of just now, which in the majority of cases only embitters the heart, and not the real punishment, the only effectual one, the only deterrent and softening one, which lies in the recognition of sin by conscience.' 'How is that, may one inquire?' asked Miusov with lively curiosity. 'Why,' began the elder, 'all these sentences to exile with hard labour, and formerly with flogging also, reform no one, and what's more, deter hardly a single criminal, and the number of crimes does not diminish, but is continually on the increase. You must admit that. Consequently, the security of society is not preserved, for although the obnoxious member is mechanically cut off and sent far away out of sight, Another criminal always comes to take his place at once, and often two of them. If anything does preserve society, even in our time, and does regenerate and transform the criminal, it is only the law of Christ speaking in his conscience. It is only by recognizing his wrongdoing as a son of a Christian society, that is, of the Church, that he recognizes his sin against society, that is, against the Church, so that it is only against the Church and not against the state that the criminal of today can recognize that he has sinned. If society, as a Church, had jurisdiction, then it would know whom to bring back from exclusion and to reunite to itself. Now, the Church, having no real jurisdiction but only the power of moral condemnation, withdraws of her own accord from punishing the criminal actively. She does not excommunicate him, but simply persists in fatherly exhortation of him. What is more, the Church even tries to preserve all Christian communion with the criminal. She admits him to church services, to the Holy Sacrament, gives him alms, and treats him more as a captive than as a convict. And what would become of the criminal, O Lord, if even the Christian society, that is, the Church, were to reject him, even as the civil law rejects him and cuts him off? What would become of him if the Church punished him with her excommunication as the direct consequence of the secular law? There could be no more terrible despair, at least for a Russian criminal. For Russian criminals still have faith. Though who knows, perhaps then a fearful thing would happen. Perhaps the despairing heart of the criminal would lose its faith, and then what would become of him? But the Church, like a tender, loving mother, holds aloof from active punishment herself. As the sinner is too severely punished already by the civil law, and there must be at least someone to have pity on him, the Church holds aloof, above all, because its judgment is the only one that contains the truth, and therefore cannot practically and morally be united to any other judgment, even as a temporary compromise. She can enter into no compact about that. The foreign criminal, they say, rarely repents, for the very doctrines of today confirm him in the idea that his crime is not a crime, but only a reaction against an unjustly oppressive force. Society cuts him off completely by a force that triumphs over him mechanically, and, so at least they say of themselves in Europe, accompanies this exclusion with hatred, forgetfulness, and the most profound indifference as to the ultimate fate of the erring brother. In this way, it all takes place without the compassionate intervention of the Church, for in many cases there are no churches there at all. For though ecclesiastics and splendid church buildings remain, the churches themselves have long ago striven to pass from church into state and to disappear in it completely. So it seems, at least in Lutheran countries. As for Rome, it was proclaimed a state instead of a church 1,000 years ago. And so the criminal is no longer conscious of being a member of the Church and sinks into despair. If he returns to society, often it is with such hatred that society itself instinctively cuts him off. You can judge for yourself how it must end. In many cases it would seem to be the same with us. But the difference is that besides the established law courts, we have the Church, too, which always keeps up relations with the criminal as a dear and still precious son. And besides that, there is still preserved, though only in thought, the judgment of the Church, which, though no longer existing in practice, is still living as a dream for the future, and is, no doubt, instinctively recognized by the criminal in his soul. What was said here just now is true, too, that is, that if the jurisdiction of the Church were introduced in practice in its full force, that is, if the whole of the society were changed into the Church, Not only the judgment of the church would have influence on the reformation of the criminal, such as it never has now, but possibly also the crimes themselves would be incredibly diminished. And there can